along with products by artisans, makers, and craftsmen at Catskills Curated. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Reporters Roundtable. Patricio Rubio checks in with our local journalists from the Sullivan County Democrat, Shawangunk Journal, and the River Reporter for updates on COVID and body cams. Bikers with Big Hearts. The Knights Order Motorcycle Club will be picking and packing vegetables at the New Hope Farm and New Hope Community. We'll check in. River Vibes concerts are back at the Cooperage. A conversation with Megan Carey, who's performing tomorrow. And do you have your pajamas on? Are you snug? Snug as a bug? Snug as a bug. Sunday readings from Miss Betty at the Wayne County Library. We'll get a preview. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Far-right demonstrators are gathering at the U.S. Capitol today to protest the ongoing criminal cases related to the January 6th attack. The protesters say the defendants are being persecuted for their political beliefs. But NPR's Meg Anderson reports that's part of an attempt to downplay the chaos of that day.
The organizers of the rally want to portray the violence on January 6th as the doing of just a few bad apples. But that's not the reality of what happened. Of the more than 600 defendants, an NPR analysis finds 1 in 5 are charged with committing an act of violence, like assaulting a police officer. At least 140 police officers were injured in the attack, including some who suffered brain damage and other serious injuries. Around 70 of the rioters charged with more serious crimes, like assault or conspiracy, are being held in pretrial detention. But most people are waiting for their trials at home. Those will likely begin next year. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
Security is tight in the nation's capital. Law enforcement officials, though, say they're confident they're ready for whatever the day may bring. Regulators are moving forward with the authorization process for Pfizer COVID booster shots, but to a much more limited group than the White House had planned for. NPR's Amy Held reports on what's next.
The FDA is expected to issue a final decision about Pfizer boosters next week after an advisory panel endorsed them for those at least 65 years old or at greater risk of severe disease. The CDC is set to meet midweek to recommend how the shots be used. Most vaccines given in the U.S. are Pfizer. But what about the tens of millions of Americans who got one of the other two? Moderna has filed an application for a third shot, and Dr. Ashish Jha with Brown School of Public Health says he expects the FDA to take it up soon.
Johnson & Johnson may be a couple of months away yet. They just got their approval later.
The White House says the supplies and infrastructure are in place to start giving out the Pfizer boosters as soon as next week. Amy Held, NPR News.
Education Secretary Miguel Cardona preparing to hit the road. NPR's Corey Turner reports he'll be talking up the Biden administration's effort to help students return to classrooms safely.
This road trip is slated to last 5 days and begins Monday with a pep rally at an elementary school in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. From there, Cardona's bus will make stops in Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. He's not the first secretary to do this kind of tour, but the stakes feel higher this year. COVID-19 is still ravaging many communities. Kids younger than 12 don't yet have access to a vaccine, and many schools are bitterly divided over safety policies like masking. So Cardona will use this tour to encourage leaders to embrace strong public health measures and to reassure anxious families that with those measures, kids can and should return to school. Corey Turner, NPR News.
This is NPR. The Biden administration is reportedly planning to fly back to Haiti thousands of migrants camped under a bridge in South Texas. The migrants have pitched tents and makeshift shelters beneath the bridge in Del Rio. The flights, first reported by the Associated Press and the Wall Street Journal, are expected to start tomorrow. The Washington Post says to expect an announcement today. SpaceX wants to launch, test and launch its massive super heavy rocket and Starship spacecraft on the southern tip of Texas. For nearly a year, federal regulators have been mulling that over. The Federal Aviation Administration has released a draft environmental assessment on allowing the company to launch from its facility there. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports.
The FAA launched a new safety office in Houston in July to oversee commercial spaceflight operators like SpaceX. When the FAA solicited public comment last December, people voiced concern over the many protected species launch site neighbors. The draft assessment said the launches didn't cause any significant new environmental impact. The report kicks off another 30-day window of comments, but does propose to give experimental licenses to the company's massive 400-foot-high Starship spacecraft and Super Heavy rocket to be launched there. A final draft assessment is not expected for several months. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
SpaceX launched the first civilian crew into space on Wednesday, and now they are expected to return to Earth this evening. Splashdown is set for the Atlantic waters off Florida's coast. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Data IQ, an AI and machine learning platform designed to give everyone in the enterprise the ability to work with and understand data for better decision-making. Learn more at dataiku.com.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. School has returned, and so have COVID cases that are positive. Pandemic has already affected the school year with positive cases and bus driver shortages. Crime in Monticello is still rampant, and the DA has an office shortage. That's all being covered by the Reporters Roundtable today. Patricio Rubio from WJFF sat down virtually with the three local journalists who typically attend our Reporter Roundtable: Liam Mayo with the River Reporter, Chris Rowley with the Shawangunk Journal, and up first, Joe Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat.
I talked with Public Health Director Nancy McGraw recently, which I think we've all probably hit up at least 100 times so far in the last year. Pretty much what she told me is that the Delta variant has become the dominant strain here, and obviously that's a more contagious variant. While summer is usually a time for teachers and students to chill out and relax, it was a very busy time for public health services and the county. They were in constant communication with the county, with schools, to try to figure out what's the best way to reopen schools. And for what has happened last week, and then they've been working with them to implement or having conversations about COVID testing programs for staff who aren't vaccinated, which there's some funding that public health has for these particular programs. And they've also had some meetings as far as surveillance testing for students, which would need parental consent. And because Nancy McGraw had told us that test data and surveillance is the best way to kind of get a handle on the prevalence of the virus. And to your point about schools going remote, Benjamin Kosar Elementary School in Fallsburg had a pretty significant number of exposures with COVID. So they've had to make some adjustments. I think there's been some other districts with the COVID case here or there. But this is sort of the uncharted territory now, now that they're sending people back to school. It's not like a hybrid model this year. And
that was something I was surprised about, that they weren't doing a hybrid model, just because, the thought process, I would think, is like they would think this might happen, which is happening now, the cases. And just to give the option to parents, who are not 100% comfortable or sending the children back to school.
Yeah, I mean, the state and the federal government has been really pushing local governments and schools to go back to an in-person model because it's just created such a large disruption to everyone else's daily lives, with people not being able to work because someone has to stay home with the kids and all this other stuff, that there really was a push to send people back to school. And we'll see how this whole thing plays out in the next couple of weeks and whether or not this was a bad decision or not.
And how about you, Liam? What have you seen in your reporting as far as schools goes? Are you seeing cases also? And how are schools dealing with the mask mandate?
Yeah, I haven't found much specifically about new cases in the areas that I look into. I don't believe either Eldred Central School District or Sullivan West has cases or exposures at this time. But what I've found is schools are trying to get back to as close to normal as possible while trying to be as safe as possible. I talked with Dr. John Morgano, the superintendent of the Eldred Central School District, a while back, and he said that safety is his number one priority for the coming school year, and that he's imposing masks. There will be temperature tests for everyone on school grounds. So they're trying to stay as safe as possible. But he also said that he is going to try as hard as possible to avoid going to some kind of hybrid or remote form of instruction. He praised the teachers and the students for trying as hard as they did the previous year when everything was forced to go remote. But he said that students just got absolutely nothing out of that. He said that students just couldn't be counted on to pay attention and that the format just wasn't suited for education. So I think schools are trying to keep safety really, really close and have that be a priority, but they don't want to give up in-person education if at all possible.
Right. No, definitely. I can see, you know, that argument that said the attention span of some elementary or high school kids, you know, might not be there if they're home on the computer and, you know, had temptation they have to play PlayStation or Xbox or not do anything. So I can see definitely that argument. It's a scary situation, I say, especially like in like what's happening in Fallsburg, right? I think some of the kids, I think 93 kids were exposed, or some number like that of kids were exposed. So it's a little scary in that situation. It's like school's just started. And how about you, Chris? What's happening in Ellenville? Because I saw in Shawanagunk that I think Ellenville or Ellenville Elementary School has went remote for a positive case there.
Yeah, it's confusing at this point. I haven't heard any real anything really straight about this. At the beginning of the year, the school district was not going to do the temperature testing. They abandoned that because they found that all the temperature tests they took last year led to this one particular temperature that wasn't normal. There's a lot of questions. I mean, the elementary, I think, is still going in person. I think that that's all carrying on. The bigger issue, and it's not just Ellenville, but particularly actually it's hitting Pine Bush, which is a much bigger school district, as you know, is school bus drivers. There's this terrible shortage of bus drivers. It's a national shortage. Bus drivers are frightened. They don't really want to be in a contained small space with a lot of children who may or may not be infected or vaccinated. So the issue, I believe, Pine Bush shut down Friday and Monday and didn't have school because they couldn't actually organize the buses. And they're working frantically to get enough drivers in. I haven't heard of any issue like that yet for Ellenville, but I have heard that they are short, and therefore there's a lot of rejigging of bus routes and everything to pick everybody up. And in a sense, this leads to a kind of fundamental question, which is another of these questions that COVID is basically asking all of us, our society. Our model of public education depends on the bus. If the bus can't pick the kids up, then none of these school districts, Fallsburg, Sullivan West, forget about it. You know, I mean, Ellenville, Pine Bush. Pine Bush is spread out over 7 towns and 3 counties. You know, I mean, the kids come a long way. If we don't have school buses, then we are going to go full remote. So this was something that COVID has come around the back and is coming in a new direction to really make things difficult. Anyway, the rest of it is what we hear from the kids is, controlled chaos.
Right. I saw one image, and I think it was a Pine Bush. Someone posted on Facebook that, you know, some of the classrooms obviously are social distance. You could spread out the desk and all that, but they showed a picture of the hallway and them and the kids transferring from one class to another. Mm-hmm. And it was like, it was shoulder to shoulder. It was terrible.
And some kids aren't wearing masks.
Yeah. That's the one thing I noticed. No one in the picture was wearing masks. Which is surprising because masks are mandated in class. So it's like I say the same situation. We were actually talking to the Jason was talking to on local edition to one of the co-owners of Rolling V Bus Company about the bus shortage. And he mentioned that, you know, the shortage that they're seeing now is sort of a combination of not only the pandemic, but he says it's been an ongoing thing as less young people are entering the industry of bus driving, I guess. And a lot of people are retiring. But then he threw this wrench in the picture, which I wasn't aware about, was the legalization of marijuana. He's saying because of that, that's throwing off everyone's job. Because of the legalization of marijuana, now there's a whole section of the population that won't be eligible to be a bus driver because they still test for drugs. And as right now, federally, marijuana is still illegal, and they're run by federally. This is important to him. So he's saying that the large population now won't be able to become bus drivers because of this. How true is that? I don't know, but this is according to him. I thought that was an interesting thing there. But like I said, we have these problems in Pine Bush. As of right now, I don't think we have a problem in Sullivan County. But what about in Ulster County? Are you seeing anything like what we're seeing in Pine Bush as far as the bus drivers go?
I've been checking around so far, no. I believe there are shortages of bus drivers that are pushing people like Vallone into rigorous scheduling. You know, I mean, they're having to use fewer resources in terms of people to cover the same routes and everything, and maybe even double up. What driver will do one route and then do another route. But I haven't spoken to Phil, and I've called him several times this morning and not got him yet. But I think they are going to have a difficult time. Now, the cannabis thing that you just mentioned, that's new to me, and that is very interesting considering where we're going. I mean, Ellenville is going to be, it seems, the center for cannabis growing and production in Ulster County, in the Hudson Valley, maybe in New York, you know. So this is coming. And that, does that mean there won't be any bus drivers? Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And, you know, last year, a lot of schools had the school bus drivers had a shift and had to adapt to the changing environment. How about you, Liam? What have you seen in your reporting?
I haven't heard any chatter about Rolling V or the bus shortages specifically. Just, it doesn't surprise me. There's just been chatter about unemployment or understaffing in essentially every area of government life, of civic life. I think there's hardly a story in the paper that doesn't include some tie-in to a department being understaffed or local restaurants not being able to find workers. So it's hard to know whether how every industry is going to have problems that are specific to its own industry in terms of unemployment. And the cannabis tie-in is new to me too. And that is an incredibly interesting wrinkle that, or an incredibly interesting ripple effect from the legalization of cannabis that would specifically impact the bus drivers industry. But it's hard to know how much of understaffing is that, how much of it is larger issues that are affecting everyone, such as lack of childcare or the pandemic or just the economy in general.
Right. It could be just a sort of a combination of things. And I guess you have to sort of wait and see after, you know, the time passed and some data has come out and you can see, you know, looking back at exactly what has caused the understaffing. Now, the bus situation also affects sports. What is the situation with sports in the schools this fall? Joseph, I know you're no longer the sports editor at the Democrat. You're the managing editor now, but you still have your hand on the pulse of sports. What's going on with sports?
There was some concern amongst parents and stuff that maybe sports would be affected again in the fall because of the virus. As of now, it doesn't appear to be the case. Sports have been happening. Luckily, most fall sports, with the exception of volleyball, takes place outdoors. So there's been a little more leeway with that, and kids have been playing. Football has had 1 week for everyone, 2 weeks for some schools. But the bus driver shortage, it's interesting that you guys brought it up, because that's actually, I think, to Chris's point, also had a larger effect on sports, because there were a couple instances where we were supposed to cover a cross-country meet. I think recently they were supposed to have like 4 or 5 county schools, but two of them couldn't make it to the meet because they wouldn't have a bus over there until like 6 o'clock. So technically the transportation side, to Chris's point, talking about Pine Bush having to go all over their region. I mean, these schools in the Hudson Valley, I mean, Sullivan County schools play schools as far out as O'Neill and Highland Falls. You've got Pine Plains, which is pretty north of Rhinebeck. So we have such far distances to travel that this bus driver shortage has been, I think, having some effect on sports as well. But I will say about the school bus driver shortage, I think that this problem actually has sort of been happening for a while, even before cannabis. I mean, I think it's to an extreme point now. But I've noticed for the last couple of years, you always get these flyers in the mail. I don't know about you guys, where it's like, hey, become a bus driver. There's a $3,000 sign-on bonus or whatever. So technically, there's definitely been an incentive and a need for bus drivers. But I think with everything else, it's sort of, getting worse with the pandemic. And to your point about the kids in school, walking shoulder to shoulder and not enforcing of the masks, I have spoken to some educators who I happen to know in the community. They talk about how it's difficult enough to control a classroom, and it's, possibly even more so to have to kind of add a mask policing sort of component to your job. So I know that's something people have been struggling with. So sports, like I said, is going back to that topic, is happening. So hopefully it will continue, but I think it all kind of depends on where this bus driver shortage and where the COVID numbers kind of continue to determine how much we actually get.
Switching gears here a little bit, I want to talk about the recent crimes that have been happening in Monticello. I know, Joe, you didn't write the article. It was written by the editor, Matt Shortall. But if you could talk about the recent uptick in crime in Monticello, because this is something the Sullivan County DA's office has also talked about. And she talked about this in combination with her office being understaffed. And, we were talking about bus drivers being understaffed, but she's saying that she's understaffed and she's losing ADAs, assistant district attorneys, to other counties who are paying better or paying more.
Yeah, I mean, Monticello recently at a village board meeting that Matt had attended, some residents that came concerned about public safety. There was a couple of shootings in a small period of time. But going to Megan's point, when she was speaking to legislators at the beginning of the month, she had announced in public safety and law enforcement committee that violent crime is up, but also felony arrests are up. So those are two different components. As far as violent crime goes, she said what you're seeing is it's not necessarily spread throughout the county. It's not like you're seeing violent crime upticks in Monticello and in Calicoon or Jeffersonville, Wurtsboro, but it seems to be in pockets. And I think that in Sullivan County's case, even though it wasn't specifically stated, you could contribute the incidents that occurred in Monticello as maybe a pocket or a little small location where stuff was happening. As far as felony arrests, which aren't always, they're serious offenses, but not always violent crimes. Those are actually up, she said, year over year, 35% in Sullivan County. And she was asked by legislators if she thought bail reform had something to do with it. And she believed that it did. And she gave the example of one individual that has 16 open cases currently in the county keeps getting arrested. And it's not necessarily violent crimes, but some serious offenses that this person's been committing. So she had said that bail reform, she believed, answering the question has had a negative impact on crime in the county. So that's one side of things. And to your point about the shortage of ADAs, she has mentioned a few times that there's the need for it. There's been talk in Sullivan County for a long time about wages, and that's not just when it comes to, lawyers. It's across the board as far as wages compared to maybe other areas. And, she had mentioned that she's lost a lot of ADAs to other counties surrounding because of higher wages. And, she also mentioned that because, she had cut her budget like a lot of other county departments during COVID, and it's been hard because when you're losing ADAs and stuff, they have a lot more work they have to do now because the state troopers recently started being equipped with body cameras. And now if you're an ADA and you have to review a case, you have to review the body cam footage from the incident from not just that one police officer, but every police officer who's at the scene. So that has created
industries. Liam, what have you seen in your reporting?
Yeah, I mean, it's a case where rising crime has puts more pressure on already overstressed situations and just makes those situations worse. It's as there's rising crime pressuring the ADA's office, and as the ADA has to review that body cam footage and spend more time for each individual case, that just creates so much more work on their organization and exacerbates the already severe staffing issues, where they're losing assistant district attorneys and where they're understaffed and underpaid. And it affects...
I don't want to cut you off there, Liam, but if you, can you go into that a little bit, that the requirement now for sort of the DA's office to review the body cam footage from police officers?
Oh, yeah, of course. The body camera legislation that she mentioned apparently was passed as part of police reform laws by the Cuomo administration, where assistant district attorneys have to review all of the footage within 20 days of an arrest for a person who has been 35 days for a person who has not been incarcerated. So that creates very time sensitive work, also very time consuming work, which pushes other things away. And I believe she mentioned at the legislative meetings that when several officers are at an incident, all of their body cameras go off. So it's not enough to just review the footage from one person's camera to find out what happened. You have to legally look at all of that footage.
That's the Reporters Roundtable. Patricia Ravallo speaking with Liam Mayo from The River Reporter, Chris Rowley from Shawangunk Journal, and Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat. While we were on the air with this story, we heard from Monticello Central School District. Robert J. Kaiser Middle School, RJK Middle School, will go to remote learning September 20 to 24th, that's next week, due to COVID exposure at the school. 42 students and 6 staff were in close proximity with someone who had COVID, and the school is now reporting 3 active COVID cases. All other schools, including St. John's, will remain open next week. Again, Robert J. Kaiser Middle School, RJK, will go to remote learning September 20th through the 24th due to COVID exposure. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Hope Farm gets harvesting help from the Knights Order Bikers. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
The Radio Catskill Community Awards, September 30th, honoring our healthcare heroes for making a difference. Nancy McGraw, Sullivan County Public Health. Julie Pizzal, The Kingfisher Project. Sullivan 180. Wayne Memorial Hospital and Community Health Centers. And Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. Join us at Calicoon Hills, September 30th. Ticket information at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Hope Farm is a 3-acre organic farm on the grounds of SUNY Sullivan in Liberty, which is operated by New Hope Community, providing hands-on opportunities for men and women who have intellectual and developmental disabilities. Food grown on the farm is used in New Hope Community's residential homes and by the college's culinary arts students in meal prep. And harvested items are also donated to community nutrition programs and food pantries in the region to combat food insecurity. Tomorrow, Hope Farm will get some unusual help. Volunteers from the Knights Order, a motorcycle group of first responders, law enforcement, and civilians, will assist with the busy harvesting season of picking and packing vegetables. Motorcycle enthusiasts from the fraternal group will meet staff, including individuals who have developmental disabilities, and pick and pack crops. I spoke with David Lee from the Orange County chapter of the Knights Order, who organized the effort.
The Knights Order Law Enforcement Motorcycle Group, we were established in 2018. Our president is Santiago Enoa. His road name's Patron. We're an international organization. We're approximately 300 to 400 members strong. We're in Brazil, France, Italy, and then obviously locally too nationwide. We have chapters in Florida, New York, Orange County, New York, Sullivan County, Westchester, Long Island, and so forth. We are a group made up of approximately 70% law enforcement and first responders. So you don't necessarily have to be a police officer. You could be a first responder in some other way. And the other 30% is civilian.
you're dedicated to helping out community through nonprofit fundraising efforts and other efforts, and you're going to be helping out the New Hope community at Hope Farm. Now, I don't know if a lot of folks would associate bikers and vegetables. So how did this come about?
You know, it's funny. It's funny. I'm a fully patched in member of the club now. That means I'm not a prospect anymore, like a recruit or something, you could say. Anyway, one of the things I did before becoming a patched in member as a prospect, I wanted to do something to show my dedication and contribute to the club and, you know, getting to become patched in. I wanted to do something that's something, you know, people would remember. Anyway, my son, David Joshua Lee, he lives in New Hope, the New Hope facility in Sullivan County. The Hope Farm over at the SUNY campus, they grow, they harvest vegetables, fruit, different types of things that you can pick. They put in baskets, and then some of that produce goes to goes over to New Hope. So, you know, I had thought about, maybe my club would be interested in doing something like this. So a bunch of the guys were getting together on Sunday. We're meeting up at 9:30. We're going over there around 11, 11:30 to pick vegetables, put the stuff in the baskets, and just be part of something. You know, again, it's a little personal to me because my son goes there. But with just to show the public that, you know, our group, we're not just, you know, beer and cigars. I mean, I like that too once in a while. but you know, just to show that we contribute to the community. We do charitable events. If a law enforcement family or a first responders family or any family is in need and it's something that we're made aware of, we'll get together as a group. We'll ride out to the location if there's a fundraiser happening. Sometimes we'll donate money. You know, we'll pay $25, $30 a pop, a person, to contribute to the cause. And those are the type of things we do. You know, for me, when I wanted to join the group, I didn't want to be a guy part of a bunch of, you know, tough guys. And they're not. It's not like that. They're actually a good group of individuals, of men that want to do things in society and help out. And as a motorcycle group, it's great. I'm having a lot of fun with these guys.
Where do you think that misconception comes from? Because, you know, if folks see a group of bike riders coming around the corner, they may think, you know, trouble or beer and cigars or whatever, not necessarily, hey, we're going to go help some individuals with some disabilities on their farm. How do you overcome that misperception, and why do you think it's there still?
Well, you know, I think, to answer the second part of that, I think it's there still. Because when you see, everybody has perceptions. You can't deny that. Everybody, you know, looks at something. They perceive something that may not be there. Anyway, when you see a guy in a leather jacket, see a guy in jeans and a leather jacket and maybe a beard, right away you associate that with something like whether it's bad or he's a biker and he must be something, just something not good. And it's just not true. It's just not true. By doing the things that we do, by these charity events, by talking to you on the radio, by maybe getting on the news or on TV. A lot of the law enforcement motorcycle groups are like that in terms of just being charity, hardworking individuals. Our club's premise or slogan, one of the slogans we have, it's family, work, and then the club. The club in that order, as you see, comes last because family comes first. Your job, you got to, you know, survive, and then the club. So if we can't make a ride, like if I'm a guy in this club, I can't make a ride. Nobody's giving me a hard time about it. All right, you make the next ride, or eventually, or just keep in touch with us. So that's the kind of group this is. And to break the, as I said, well, I should say to break the stigma, I think just continually being in people's faces. If we are at a bar, sitting down having a drink together, you know, we interact with the public. They don't have to be part of the club. We're not treating people bad. We're not destroying things or doing anything bad. You know what I mean? At least this club isn't. There is a thing called one percenters where you have a one percenter. 1% of the clubs out there are bad. There are bad clubs out there, but not us. The 99% of the clubs out there that do the kind of things we do, they're all good people. They're just looking to have some friendships, camaraderie, and do good things for people.
I wanted to ask about your son, and does he enjoy your motorcycle group? Does he have an affinity for the biking as well?
Well, I have a 29-year-old son that he is autistic. He's on the spectrum. He knows what I do. He hasn't ridden with me. I think it'll be a little too much for him. I probably could. He hasn't ridden with me yet, I should say. You know, he'd be able to. But my son Joshua, David Joshua, I call him Josh. Josh lives over in, as I said, in the farm at New Hope, at the New Hope facility. He is fully. He's very high on the spectrum. He can't speak. He needs full assistance. So for him to ride with me, it would probably be a little difficult and overwhelming for him if you understand autism. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't really get it. But for me as a dad, for me being part of the club, I think it's therapeutic for me. I get to do something for him in a way that maybe he doesn't know, or maybe he does know a little bit when I talk to him about it. I think it's something that I do for myself, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, you're doing it for the whole New Hope community, because food on the farm is used in the residential homes and by the culinary arts students in meal prep. You're working with the folks, the head farmer Megan Green, and the other folks there as well.
They've been great too. They've been wonderful people.
Yeah,
been great with everything.
What other projects or other events do you guys have coming up or you're thinking about planning?
Well, anytime we have a ride, anything that we're going to do, we have a confirmed rides page. This is how we organize ourselves and, you know, make sure our president, Santiago Inoa, he runs the whole thing, into the international everything. But we have pages that we keep in touch with. So if we have a confirmed ride, then we see those rides, and then as many guys that can get together, they get together. One of the rides, we have one coming up on the 25th, I know, besides the one coming up on the 19th, mine, for the Officer Mulkeen that was killed when he was killed back in 2019, I believe it was. We have that ride coming up. That's in Monroe, New York. The Orange County chapter, the Knights Order Orange County chapter, is going to be part of that. We're going to be doing that one. And again, those proceeds will go to the family. We have another one. There's one that's coming up on the 26th. A ride for it was a Westchester County corrections officer that died from cancer. The benefits from that, I think it was his name was, they have him on there as Scooties, I believe it was. Anyway, we have a ride coming up on that one. His road name was Robo, they called him. Forgive me, I just can't remember. My wife knew him, my wife Monica knew him very well, because she worked with him at the place, at the jail in Valhalla. And he was a great guy, and he unfortunately he withered away from cancer. So they got that ride coming up. So everything we do, again, it's a lot of it's related to former law enforcement, corrections, police, EMS. But again, if there's something out there for lost kids, missing kids, anything benefiting that, you can guarantee the Knights Order is going to probably have a couple of guys there representing to represent the club and so forth.
You mentioned that you're no longer a prospect, but a full-fledged member. If there's somebody listening to this and wants to get some more information about the Knights Order, where should they go?
Absolutely. They can go on to the Knights Order Law Enforcement, Knights Order LEMC, or just put in Knights Order Law Enforcement Motorcycle Group. That might be a little too long, but if you put in Knights Order LEMC, the webpage will come up. There's a Facebook page. We're always looking for new members. If you're non-law enforcement and you want to be part of the group, we can give it a consideration. You could be like a ride-along for a little while. We get to know you. And maybe you become a prospect. Also, obviously, if you're military, former military, police, obviously, former police, you get an application. We check you out for a little while to make sure you fit right with the club. We don't want bad people in our club. We want good people, that want to be part of things and good, just good people. So we will, you become a prospect for a little while, and then you get patched in like I did. That's how we do it.
We've been talking to David Lee from the Knights Order, a social organization, motorcycle public safety club that is dedicated to supporting fellow brothers, their families, and the community. They will be at Hope Farm at the SUNY Sullivan campus tomorrow, Sunday the 19th, from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. to help pick and pack vegetables. There's more information at newhopecommunity.org. David, thank you for joining us, and thanks for the great work that you and your group are doing.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much.
This is Radio Chatskill. After a short break, a conversation with singer-songwriter Megan Carey, who's kicking off the River Vibes concert series tomorrow at the Cooperage. We'll be right back.
On this week's On the Media, how the T-word came to define the right's response to the president's vaccine mandate.
Medical tyranny is still tyranny, and that's exactly what this Biden administration is trying to push on American people.
Also, the complicated history behind the religious exemption. On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This afternoon at 4.
From their origins as a working Dakar nightclub band to their breakup and world-conquering return, there's never been a group like Senegal's Orchestre Baobab. Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. We'll sit down with founding members of the group and look back on their 50-year musical career. Next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRX.
Saturday night at 9 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The first River Vibes concert since February 2019 is coming up tomorrow at 4 p.m. outdoors at the Cooperage Project in Honesdale with Megan Carey. Carey's music has been called healing, inspiring, and outrageously joyful, and she's garnered favorable comparisons to Melissa Etheridge, Brandi Carlile, and even Bruce Springsteen. I spoke with Megan Carey about her message of unity in her music and how she started as a singer from a deeply personal place. You didn't mean to be a musician. You say that in your own about section of your bio on your website. and you address some tragedy pretty directly right on in the first paragraph. Can you tell folks about how you became a musician? It's an unexpected turn of events.
Yeah, and it's actually, it colored my music. It launched my music and changed my life. I was actually pre-medicine at university at first. Like that's where I started in my life. And there were a bunch of twists and turns. And the biggest turn was I met a man, Matthew, and he was a fabulous flat picker. And we fell in love and we were engaged to be married. And I used to sing with him. I used to sing the chorus. The harmony to the chorus, to all those songs that you sing in a bar and, you know, love to wave your pint to and cry in your beer over. And very unexpectedly, he passed away. And when he died, one of the things that I felt like I could keep and that I had to keep something, I had to have something, because everything, all my plans, what I thought was the next part of my life was just, you know, exploded as it does. And so I picked up his guitar and I figured out how to play it so that I could, because I wanted to keep singing. I wanted to keep making music. So I loved that he brought to my life. And, but I didn't know any of the songs, beyond the chorus. Like I didn't know the lyrics. I didn't know the tune. I didn't even know the melody. I only knew the harmony to the chorus, all these songs. So I just started writing my own, and with no intention of playing them for anyone else. They were for me. They were for me to sing and to have music in my life. And one thing led to another, and I ended up, I was actually up in the Catskill Mountains at the time, doing a play, and some of the other cast members heard me playing in my room. They said, "Why don't you come out here and play some of that music?" I said, "I don't know how to play music." And they're like, "Well, we hear you doing something. Why don't you come out here and do it?" And so I did. I went and I shared some of the songs, and then it became a thing. They'd say, "What do you write? What did you write? You know, what have you got for us?" And that was the start of sharing it. And, you know, once you're sharing music, you realize that is like 90% of the magic of music is sharing it. So it just kept going.
You say, quote, "I wrote my grief into my music and sang my way out of the abyss," end quote.
Yeah.
How did you find that strength? How did you do that?
Well, you know, the thing about grief is that no matter how much you want to, you cannot go around it, and You can't go over it. You can't go under it. You just have to go right through it. You have to walk through it. And I guess, I was blessed to have this outlet, this way to sort of speak my pain. You know, they say when words aren't enough, you break into song. And so these feelings that perhaps words weren't enough for, I was able to sing them. And I really do think that's what got me through that, and my fabulous family and my, you know, my village of people who gathered around, and everybody who loved Matthew and loves me, and they, you know, I had no intention of making a record, and I just wanted to make a tape. Like, I wanted to record these songs. This was a long time ago. I wanted to make a cassette tape of the songs that I'd written so that I could give them to my friends and to Matthew's family. And but I had no idea how to do that. Like, I didn't have a microphone. And I was like, I don't know how to get these down on a record, you know, on a recording. So, you know, people around me were like, oh, well, you should record these. I'm like, I'd love to do that. But, and so people just came out of the woodwork, and I ended up meeting this producer, you know, a friend of a friend introduced me to this guy, and he ended up, you know, saying, yeah, I'll record these songs and it'll cost this much. And then I ran out of money, and he's like, well, we want to finish them anyway. So just go ahead and we'll just, I said, I can't pay you even later. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm living in New York City, and I'm on a really limited budget. And I think I'm done. He's like, no, we're going to keep going. And you don't have to pay us. You just have to promise that you'll release these songs, like make CDs and release them. I was like, what do you mean? Well, who's going to buy my music? I really didn't have any concept of that this is what I was going to do. And but I was led by this group of people who just were so supportive, and they got me through the whole thing, and then out on the other side in a really wonderful place.
And great things came from that. A Critics' Choice for Best Newcomer from Billboard magazine, charting across the world. Do you think that your message of songs of compassion and healing power, those messages are being heard even more loudly now during these unusual times?
Oh, yeah. So much so. I mean, you know, my music has grown a lot from where I started, obviously, but... And when I first started writing, I was writing so much of my pain into song. And then it, you know, started sort of the alchemy of music. I started morphing it into finding the joy in all of these things. And right now, when we do a show, I feel people, like in that microcosm of 45 minutes or 2 hours or however long we're together, kind of going through that journey together with me. They're going from the, you know, just really, everyone's got a lot of grief right now. There's a lot that we're grieving from the past year and a half, and so many losses of, you know, life and of our lives and things that are so important to us. But we have to carry on. We have to move through it. And I feel people go through this journey when we're doing a show. And I think now more than ever, we really need the healing power of music that sort of shows you the other side, the light at the end of the tunnel, I guess.
The ending paragraph in your bio, which I also love, where you talk about life balance, and you say, quote, as soon as I think I've written my own story, someone comes along and changes the setting or the plot or the characters, usually all three. And then you say what your mantra is. Can you tell folks what your mantra is when those things happen?
If you don't know the words, sing louder, you know, because you just have to get it out there. And that, I find that I I think I have it all. I just have my finger on it, and I know exactly how it's going to go, and I'm completely prepared. And then, oh, you know, then I had two kids. Oh, and then, you know, we moved. You know, it's something always comes in. Oh, there's a pandemic. And you know, you just have to sing at the top of your lungs. That's my answer.
We've been speaking with Megan Carey. She is kicking off the 2021 season of River Vibes concerts at the Cooperage tomorrow, September 19th at 4 p.m. There's more information at thecooperageproject.org or at Megan's website, megancarey.com, megancarey.com. Megan, thanks for joining us and have a great show.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much for having me. And I'm really looking forward to seeing everybody outside at the Cooperage.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Now a bedtime story. Every Sunday evening at 7 p.m., Betty Lawson, the children's librarian at Wayne County Public Library, reads bedtime stories live on Facebook. I spoke to Betty about her bedtime stories from her home to yours, snug as a bug. So you're the children's librarian. You have story time, snug as a bug. How did this come about?
Well, oh gosh, it was about three years ago. I saw on the news that a principal in Texas was doing it, and I thought, this is such a great idea. I have a house with a couch I can sit on. I have pajamas. I have books. I think I can do it. And sometimes I come up with an idea, but it takes me a little while to wrap my head around how I'm going to pull it off. So, April, 2.5 years ago, I started, and I came up with the name Snug as a Bug Sunday Story Time. And I literally sit on my couch every Sunday at 7 o'clock. I set up a camera. I put on a mic, and I read a story. And we do a checklist. All of us do a checklist. You know, are you in your pajamas? Are you feeling cozy? Are you feeling snug as a bug? And then we start reading. And at the end, we do this beautiful mantra. I make them touch their heads and say, I am smart. They touch their hearts and say, I am loved. And then we stretch out our arms and say, I am wonderful.
And how was the first Snug as a Bug story time reading for you? Were you nervous?
Oh, I was a wreck, and I'm still 2.5 years later. I'm a nervous wreck every before I start every single time. And somebody just told me recently, I said, I can't believe it, I'm still nervous. Just before I hit the click live. Once I click live, I'm fine. But somebody said, that's okay. You know, when you stop being nervous, that's when you're no longer good at it. So I must be really good because I'm really nervous all the time. Yeah, I was very nervous. I was afraid, even though I was giving teasers ahead of time about it, even though I had tons of shares on Facebook, I was still afraid that I was going to click live and nobody would show up except for my husband. But the first reading, oh my gosh, there were probably 1,000, I had 1,000 views. Mm-hmm. So I was really pleased with that.
I bet the kids love it, but I'm sure the parents love it even more. What's the reaction been from the families?
Well, the response has really been overwhelming and really, really touching. The parents put aside the time. It's maybe 15, 20 minutes every Sunday, and they show up faithfully. And what to me, it's doing two things. It's giving them some quality family bonding time, but it's also these parents to me are rock stars. They're putting aside this time on a Sunday, and they're setting an example that reading is really important. And we're going to do this together. And I have had people send me pictures of we're watching you in the pool, and they all have their cell phones. One mother sent me a picture of her son in the bathtub with a laptop propped on the toilet with my face right there watching. So that's real dedication. Not, I don't think it's about me. It's dedication to this lesson that reading is really important. So that's been really, really touching.
Well, now I know it's Saturday, but do you have a preview of what you'll be reading tomorrow for Sunday's Snug as a Bug for us?
I do. I have a book called The Little Blue Bridge, and it is a modern spin on the classic story, The Billy Goat's Gruff. Would you like me to read a little?
Yeah. I'm ready, okay. I'm ready for a nap.
Are you in your pajamas?
No.
Are you feeling cozy?
I am feeling cozy, yes.
Are you feeling snug as a bug?
I am.
All right. Well, then you've passed the test. You are ready. It's The Little Blue Bridge by Brenda Mayer, and the pictures are by Sonia Sanchez. Ruby's mind was always full of ideas. One day, she spotted some blueberries across the creek. "Let's go pick berries to bake in a pie," she said. Everyone imagined the sweet treat. "Okay with me," said Oscar Lee. "Let's give it a go," said Rodrigo. "You should stay," said Jose. "You're too little to cross the creek." "I'm not too little," Ruby said, but the boys left her behind. When they saw Santiago, they almost turned around. "Oh, no," said Rodrigo. "Do you think he's going to let us cross?" "I'll find a way," said Jose, and he started across the creek. "Why are you trip-trapping over my bridge?" bullied Santiago. "I'm going to pick berries to bake in a pie," said Jose. Santiago stood like a stone. "I'm the boss, and you can't cross unless you give me a snack." That's all you get.
Oh, we have to tune in tomorrow.
You have to tune in.
For the rest.
You'll have to tune in tomorrow.
We've been speaking with Betty Lawson. She's the children's librarian at Wayne Public Library. And in the Wayne Public Library Children's Room Facebook page, she reads every Sunday live at 7 o'clock a bedtime story, Snug as a Bug, it's called. You can go to the Wayne County Public Library's Facebook page, or you can go to waynecountylibraries.org for more information. Betty, thank you so much for doing this, and thank you for giving us a little sneak peek.
Thanks for your interest.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, a reminder of some news we heard this hour from Monticello Central School District. Robert J. Kaiser Middle School, RJK Middle School, will go to remote learning September 20th through the 24th next week due to COVID exposure at the school. 42 students and 6 staff were in close proximity with someone who had COVID. The school is reporting 3 active cases. All other schools, including St. John's, will remain open. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. I'm headed over to the Jeffersonville Jamboree on Main Street. Come by and say hi. Have a great day.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, located in Harris and Calicoon, a member of the Garnet Health System, garnethealth.org. The River Reporter newspaper in Narrowsburg, riverreporter.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
The Radio Catskill Community Awards, September 30th, honoring our healthcare heroes for making a difference, for putting the well-being of others above all else, for staying strong in these unprecedented times, including Nancy McGraw, Sullivan County Public Health. Join us at Calicoon Hills, September 30th. Ticket information at WJFFradio.org. The Radio Catskill Community Awards, honoring our healthcare heroes.
Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Your NPR station, WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit taking legal actions, providing tools for action and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.